So I kind of put this together. I'm from Yahoo Research with Michael, but my background is a little more sort of like web analysis and information retrieval. And so I've pulled out a few things that just seemed like issues that come up in a search engine, and I thought I'd just do sort of a laundry list and dive in on a couple that were close to the sort of graph analysis side, mining and some sorts of extraction from large graphs. But I sort of assumed some stuff about information retrieval background, or figured people maybe wouldn't care about it. If it turns out anybody does, it's to do with sort of like anatomy of a web search engine, or how these data structures are kind of organized, or how the query processing happens, or how the duplicate stuff works. Let me know, and we can just like digress in the middle. So this morning I started out, I had 85 slides. Now it's down to like 50. So hopefully by the end, it'll be down significantly lower than that. And so if we wind up going off in some other directions, you're only saving yourself from 85 slides worth of misery. So it's fine. It's fine to do that. Okay. So with that intro in mind, so here's sort of an overview walkthrough from the perspective of kind of like web documents and analysis. So there's sort of this classical representation going back to sort of Gerald Salton, like decades ago, the vector space model, in which we have documents and we have queries. We're going to embed them in the same space, which will be some high-dimensional RN, and we're going to define some similarity measure based on the angle between vectors, and we'll say that when I give you a query, I want the documents whose angle is smallest. Okay, so that's sort of like an incredibly naive model. It misses all of the important stuff about the documents to do with all of the different correlations among the terms, and yet it's just like everybody bewails the fact that people have tried like all these different extensions, and there isn't really anything that has supplanted that model as being like a successful approach. That there's been a million different maybe notions of how the terms should be weighted in the similarity measure, but beyond that, it's still just this sort of rudimentary model that seems to be dominant to this day in the field. Okay, so this is sort of like from maybe kind of classical IR, I guess, which is you're given a corpus which consists of a bunch of like documents that are sequences of bytes or sequences of words. And so now let's jump to the web and see what changes as we do that. So here are a few things that change, and this isn't makes no pretensions to any sort of completeness. But one thing is that typically you have more of a notion of regions of a page. So web documents typically come with title information, header information, and maybe some kinds of bits and pieces that you've extracted. And a hit in the URL may turn out to be very relevant, whereas a hit in the title may turn out to be very irrelevant due to title spam, and maybe there's a meta description keyword that doesn't even appear when the page is rendered at all, and yet it's supposed to be there to help you understand what the page is about. So there's these different regions that you're supposed to somehow represent. So certain terms may occur in multiple regions at once, and your representation should be able to separate those out. Probably more importantly, if you need a single proxy that says when a page can be ranked effectively, it's the page can be ranked effectively if and only if it has significant anchor text pointing to it. So that is, you have a document, other people have chosen to link to that document, and there's the little text on the link that says, click here for my page about document spaces. You click on document spaces. So when there exists good anchor text, typically ranking is good, and otherwise typically ranking is just like swamped by masses of adversarial approaches to stuffing keywords into pages, and is generally pretty difficult to get right. So this is another piece of sort of ancillary information, and again, your representation needs to separate it out. I sort of separated out hyperlinks and anchor text because the hyperlinks are actually, in addition to just sort of like giving you some terms that are supposed to tell you something about the page, and in many cases represent the judgment of a third party about the page, which is why they're so important. In addition, there's just the links themselves. So there are all these models of kind of like propagation of information down links or down links backwards that are meant to capture something about the corpus. So there's an underlying graph whose vertices are documents and whose edges are directed and represent hyperlinks. And I'll talk mostly about that graph. There's also spam of like more varieties than I can really count. It seems like there's a new one every day. There are people who put white on white keywords on pages and try and mislead you that way, and people who create big giant collections of websites that link to one another and nepotistically sort of explain that this is the best page about Michael Jordan or Britney Spears. And there's various categories that sort of mean that you can't really trust many aspects of the representation. There's also site level structure. So if you have an individual page that sits with many other pages on the site, yahoo.com, then there may be properties that are actually common across pages on the site. Maybe there's a header that's the same on all the pages, or maybe there's a sidebar that's common. So that's a template of the site. It's very disturbing if you remember back in the old days of sort of web search, you type in a keyword and your first 40 hits would be identical stuff because you got a hit in the template. And so understanding that kind of structure is also pretty important. There's other site level metadata, like if the page sits on a high quality site or a site that has an entry point page, much of whose anchor text says something, then that may tell you more about the site that you'd like to use. Not too much is actually done in practice along those lines, but everybody sort of accepts that it's a nice dream that we should all be making use of that information. Okay, so these are maybe like a few ways in which we're deviating from the nice clean model that is the classical model. There's also new document types that don't really fit the current model, and the standard one is documents that are message structured. So if you follow any blogs, the way a blog works is that I choose to publish a blog which is going to be my diary in which I tell you about all of my relationships and why they didn't work. And day by day, I give you more information about this. And each one is a message. So there's like a hierarchical, there's a two-level data model here that says that there's the blog itself, which has an author and a topic. As it turns out, they all have the same topic. So, and then within the blog, there's these messages. And the messages have metadata like a timestamp. So it's not even clear, like even simple things like if I do a search, should I return a message or a blog? Even that's not clear. So we don't really know anything about how to sort of cope with these structures. Furthermore, because we've introduced time in a more formal manner than we usually have it on the web, it's now possible to talk about the evolution both of the content of a blog and also of the graph that connects the blogs. So I threw in just a couple of slides on things that come up in that context as well. Okay, so let me start with some just plain web graph stuff. Maybe initially some characterization. So when we talk about the graph, there's actually like a bunch of different graphs. This is actually a picture that's supposed to characterize the graph, not connecting pages, but here connecting machines through physical connections. This is the autonomous systems graph on the internet. And they have this sort of jellyfish characterization of what that graph looks like. This is supposed to somehow tell you something about how these machines are connected together. But I'm not going to go there. I'm going to instead just sort of like pop up to the web graph itself on the pages and say that we're kind of thinking about a graph that, to update those numbers, we're sort of imagining probably order of, Yahoo publishes 20 billion pages is the number of documents in its index. And most of the search engines have very small overlap with one another. So if we believe numbers like that, maybe we believe that there are 100 billion distinct pages out there.
Sorry, are we talking statically generated pages? What's the...
I see. I guess we're talking indexed pages. Fraction that are statically generated is, I don't actually know, it's pretty high because usually crawlers are very averse to going too far into a dynamically generated content, but the ones that are dynamically followed more deeply are the ones that we have external information to say that they're actually backed by some database such that each page has some nugget of information that's novel, like an Amazon product or, yeah.
Or Amazon.
Right. Imagine that there are maybe 10 or 20 edges per page. So we're looking at the order of getting up to a trillion edges in this graph. The kinds of graphs that you might actually see floating around might look more like 10 or 20 billion pages, something like 100 billion plus edges. So that what that means practically is that most of the algorithms that you'd like to implement it's not really realistic to hold information about each vertex in memory at the same time, and it's certainly not realistic to hold information about each edge. Okay, so here's an observation. This is an experimental observation. This is sort of like a weird sideways CDF that's kind of hard to read, and I'm sorry it looks this way. But there's an experiment that we did to create this chart, which is the following. Begin with the graph. Uniformly at random, select a vertex. Follow outlinks transitively until I've reached the entire reachable set from that vertex, and then see how many things I hit. So this is how big that reachable set is, and this is the cumulative fraction of vertices that hit a set of that size. So the way to read this is that for about half the vertices, we hit the entire graph. And then for the other half of the vertices, we hit a much smaller number of neighborhood, mm-hmm. and then we stopped. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is doing the same thing, only traversing the edges backwards. And you can see that it's not exactly the same, but the high-level view is pretty much the same. That when you start a vertex and follow out to a page that links to that vertex and the pages that link to those vertices, again, about half the time you find that you reach the entire, actually more formally, this is really about half the graph, it's not the entire graph, but it's a constant fraction.
Is this a synthetic graph or is portion of the internet or something that you crawled?
So this is 200 million pages that represented the crawl of Alta Vista at the time, 2000. So now the question is, I guess I'll give you one, oh, sorry, yes.
These nodes that are not connected to the whole web, how did Alta Vista even come across them in the first place?
Right. So in particular on this page, the ones that don't have many inlinks. So there's a few mechanisms. One is most search engines remember when they found something, they never forget it, and then the links to that thing disappear, but they continue getting recrawled. So there are these giant seed lists. Another is that people actually submit their pages for crawling. I guess there are a couple of other sort of little things like that. But it turns out to be really important that it actually results in a lot of the structure in that picture. So I'll give you one other fact about this, which is that the 50% of pages here, which sort of exploded and hit the entire graph, and the 50% of pages here, which exploded and hit the entire graph, overlap in 25% of the pages. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is now an observation, and the question is, what must the graph look like in order mm-hmm. to produce this mm-hmm. picture? So then here's the answer, right? So here is a decomposition that I can apply to any directed graph. So I'll take the graph, I'll find the largest strongly connected component. I'll just remind you that a strongly connected component is a subset of the vertices such that for any ordered pair, there's a path from one to the other. Okay, so think of it as being sort of like fully connected. Everybody can reach everybody else. So I can perform processing on the graph to decompose it into strongly connected components. That's an equivalence relation. And then
Yeah. Consider symmetric links, or when you say strongly?
Yeah, so strongly connected, we're not considering symmetric links. So that's why I need to talk about ordered pairs. So my decomposition that I can just apply to any graph, this is just a definition, is that I'll do this strongly connected component finding algorithm. I'll pick an instance of the largest component, which we have reason to believe that there's only going to be one largest component, which is the giant component. I'll call that, I'll call that kind of the single giant strongly connected component of the graph. Then I'll find everything that I can reach from that component, and I'll call that out. I'll find everything that reaches that component, I'll call that in. And then everything else I'll just label using various miscellaneous terms.
Yeah, you can do that. That's a multi graph from 2001.
Yeah.
How it look like today?
There have been a couple of other experiments.
More order. How do that order?
This is a little smaller, this is a little bigger.
Okay. And the center?
The center, I think, may be a little bigger. It kind of, it's so dependent on the particular nature of the crawler and how long people have been crawling for, that I think the jury's still out on what the actual evolution of this structure is, or what the true structure was even back when this happened.
So the ing is a smaller RGB, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what people have been publishing. Ing's a little smaller, that's a little bigger. Okay, so you can sort of imagine, so what happens in our little experiment? So let's say we're considering outlinks of a vertex. If I pick a vertex that's here or here, then I'll be able to reach this component, which means that I can then reach everything in here, which means that I can then reach everything in here. So this path is small, and these are 50% of the vertices. So that gives me my 50% that I hit. Okay, going backwards, if I start here or here and follow links the other way, I can reach all of this and all of this. So that gives me my 50%. And this is the 25% overlap in those two sets. So hence the structure explains the earlier graphs, which is what sort of suggested this is the structure.
So how do you crawl the web backward? You're looking at an HTML page.
Right, so there's an approach to this that says it's possible for me to write code that will go and fetch a page and take the links and follow them forward. So I could possibly do some of this forward link following actually like on the live web. It might be prohibitive because this is maybe 100 million pages or so. But in this case, and in all related experiments, we need to implement some sort of like reachability question. So there was a large in-memory database built on a big machine that Compaq had floating around, using extremely aggressive compression on the edges. I'll just mention that the compression on the edges that was used back then has been improved on significantly recently, and now the compression of edges in the web graph is down to 3 bits per edge. That's the that there are actual algorithms implemented that perform that compression. So the entropy is no more than 3 bits per edge.
Could you drop the rest of the talk and just tell us how that's done?
Yeah.
Sure.
So the primary observation is that if you sort the source vertex of each edge lexicographically by the URL, that gives you great locality within the site and the subsite. And then if you have some kind of clever encoding that's appropriate for repeated edges that occur sort of like in a local neighborhood, what are the popular pages in the subsite, which is basically like a truncated LZW style.
I understand.
Okay, great. So this is sort of the picture. This was a group of Italians, Paolo Boldi, Vespignani, and maybe one other person, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Last year?
I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe. Yeah, I could probably dig up a pointer if you want. But yeah, so it's well referenced. In fact, they have a really nice implementation as well that allows like rapid accesses into the graph. So it's very attractive to try and somehow shoehorn this into memory in order to run computations like this, because if not, trying to do like an out-of-core traversal that will give you these reachability numbers is very difficult. So if you imagine you just want to implement this in some naive way, then every time you do a fetch to get the links out of a particular node, you have to actually seek. Even if you've got your index blocks all set up so they're cached, you have to seek once to get to the page that has that content, and that probably means that on one disk you can do like 300 of these a second, and you have 100 million that you need to do for each random start node. So it's totally prohibitive, even if you manage to seek only once per vertex. In fact, any algorithm on this graph that requires one seek per vertex, random access per vertex, is out of the question. So everything has to be shoehorned into some sort of a sequential access model. Sorry, I'm all over the place. So we have our picture. We're okay with it. It seems to make sense. And that gives us kind of our high-level structural picture of the graph. So here are a couple of observations. First, the probability, so for uniform U and V, the probability that U is reachable from V is 1 in 4. Right. So why is that? Well, the only way that U is reachable from V, really, is that U is in the union of these two components, and V is in the union of these two components. Otherwise, the only way that you can be reachable is to be within some tiny like path over here or over here, and they're essentially, that's like a zero measure kind of effect. And those two are just chosen uniformly, independently, and so it's probability a half of starting here, probability a half of finishing here. So that means that if you just pick a couple of random pages and ask if you can get from one to the other, you can't. Three quarters of the time, you can, which is a little disturbing. Okay, so the max distance between two nodes in that strong component in the center is 28. I don't know what those nodes are. The max distance between two nodes conditioned on them having a distance is greater than 900. But this is not a property that you should pay any attention to, because somebody can just randomly string together a bunch of pages and this number grows. This is a little more interesting. The average distance between two nodes in the SCC is 16. I thought there was one more. So I'll just tell you the one other thing. If you now take those same nodes that are in the strongly connected component and you remove the directionality on the edges, so now you make it symmetric, so you allow people to go either forwards or backwards, then the average distance between two nodes is 6, which is the same 6 that we all expect from 6 degrees of separation papers that have been inundating our mailbox list since the 1950s. Okay, so let's go one step further. This is based on the question, is it possible to introduce the term fractal into a web paper, thus guaranteeing that it will be accepted? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. And so each of these is supposed to represent a small subcommunity. So we sort of tried to pick every way that we could think of as defining a meaningful subcommunity. So it's all pages that mention a location west of Mississippi, all pages that talk about some branch of mathematics, all pages that come from a particular set of domains or from .edu or whatever. Every way we chose to do this, when we analyzed the resulting subgraph, we found one of these bow ties in the subgraph. Okay, so that's extremely unlikely. Right? You imagine that if you take a graph that has that kind of a decomposition and you randomly downsample it, all of that connectivity structure is going to vanish. And we were downsampling to graphs of 50,000 nodes or so.
But you were down. You were. It wasn't.
But we weren't doing it randomly.
Right.
We were doing it in a way that.
Oh, I see. You're saying that it would be unlikely if
it would be unlikely.
Randomly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So somehow the web is emerging as this graph, which is locally quite dense but globally is sparse. You know, degree is 10 on average. There are these 100 billion edges and 10 billion vertices or 20 billion vertices. And yet, if we look at particular local regions, we find that there's all this connectivity. Okay, so this now gives us kind of a view that says that each community has its own kind of strongly connected region, and then may have some regions that lie out here in the bowtie at large, or out here. And the components within each of these are actually well connected. So these edges represent kind of a navigational backbone of the web, if you will. So the idea would be that you're trying to get from here over to this page about some totally unrelated topic, so you have to take the taxi to the airport and then, you know, take a flight over to differential whatever geometry up here, and then take the taxi again to your final destination. Okay, so that was pretty scary.
What was the word fractal?
What was that? Did you say?
Self-similar.
Self-similar.
Yeah, self-similar. Yeah, right. So from here, I guess I'll just sort of walk through this really quickly. So we have this graph, and now we want to make use of it. And somehow we want to have a document representation which captures this, but we need to ask like why we would want to use this graph. And so here are just a few things that are sort of commonly done. The first is that there's link-based static ranking, which means that if you can just sort of observe the graph and perform some operation on it in order to assign an importance to every page, then that'll be just some global query-independent notion of the importance of every page on the web. Okay, so that's a very powerful thing, because it means that now when you structure your index is going to have in it somewhere something that says, there's a word dog, and here's every page that mentions this word dog. And there's a word cat, and here's every page. And it's probably 10 million pages. And so when somebody comes along and queries for cat and dog, what you'd like to do is sort of walk down these lists, but you don't want to have to actually look at 10 million pages in both cases, find the 1 million where they overlap, and examine each one to see which the best is. What you'd like to do instead is early termination of the query. So you'd like to kind of start at the beginning of those lists, walk down them, and then as soon as you found some really good ones, say, well, that's probably the best stuff, and return it to the user. But the only way you can do that is if there's a single globally consistent ordering that you can put all of those lists in, so that you can now merge them together as you traverse, zip them together. So a static ranking gives you such an ordering, and ones based on the graph with maybe other metadata thrown in are kind of the typical thing to use. So this started with Google and PageRank, and the idea of the particular static ranking being used there was that you treat the graph as a Markov process defined as follows. So a particle starts in the process, and at each step, it chooses uniformly from the outlinks of a particular page and follows those outlinks. But that's not ergodic. There are a lot of sinks in that graph and a lot of other problems. In fact, if you look at the bow tie, everything's just going to zip into. And there are disconnected components, so there are a lot of problems. So in order to just apply a sort of sledgehammer fix, let's just add a link from everywhere to everywhere and say that with probability some small amount, as I'm walking around, I'll just go to a uniform location and start again. Okay, so that's a Markov process. It's a dense matrix, but it has a very simple structure because it's the matrix of the graph, which is sparse, plus this other matrix that comes from the uniform jumps. So it's possible to do a pretty efficient computation of the principal eigenvector of that matrix. And people have written probably in excess of 20 billion papers about ways to speed that up.
They're all indexed.
That's one thing we need is that are really good. Sorry if anyone is. I'm in that community. So now, once we compute that steady state, that gives us a score for every page, which is supposed to represent, if I go surfing around on the web and just like randomly follow links until I'm in some steady state, the pages that I'm most likely to be at are the pages that should be placed most highly in this static ranking. Okay, so I'll use that trick. It will allow me to get this early termination out of my index, and so this is the primary sort of thing that people point to as a way to use the graph. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is sort of batch mining operations. Like, you're given the graph, and you're supposed to have an algorithm that will produce every community in the graph, or produce every dense subgraph of a certain form, or produce all the link spam farms that people create to try to fool the first PageRank operator. Okay, so I'll tell you one of these. And then there's also online query processing in the graph, where you give it a query, and somehow you're supposed to work on this graph in real time and return somebody some information. There isn't much along these lines. I'll tell you about one thing here. Okay, and then that'll end the graph thing. We'll do a little bit on evolution, a little bit on message stuff, and then that's the whole thing. Okay, so batch processing. All right, so maybe the situation is that there are a lot of pages, and it's hard to pay someone enough to kind of read them all. Originally, this was the model, that we just have someone, in fact, this is how Yahoo started, right? Someone would go read all the pages and then tell people what the good ones were. The graph is a lot smaller. It's certainly kind of cut down. So can we somehow extract some notion of semantic knowledge? In particular, we're looking for community structure from this graph. Okay, so here's the fishing community online in an abstract representation. So there's a couple of pages like Bill's Fishing Resources here, which are sort of like hub pages. And there's a sort of a formal notion of a hub page and an authority page, which if anybody would like to know what that is, ask me. But until I'm asked, I won't say anymore. So a hub page sort of links to the good stuff, and authority pages are like what the hubs tend to link to. So that's a recursive definition that you can evolve to a steady state. So maybe this is it. Bill's Fishing Resources and Outdoor Magazine. So here's the Linux community. There's sort of Joe's Linux links page, and then there's the Linux documentation project, which everybody agrees is the great place, and everybody links to it and says, this is great. Okay, so these are just two different random communities. They have very different structure. So our observation is that I can kind of look at both those communities and observe that there are two pages that I could color red if I chose, and then maybe in each one I can find three pages that include these kind of authoritative ones that I could color green, such that if I throw the rest away, it's the same subgraph. So let's just sort of briefly look at the subgraph. So this is a bipartite graph from the rest of the greens that's complete. So every red-green pair has an edge between them. So this is like a K2-3. It's a complete bipartite graph. Okay, so let's perform a brief experiment, just sort of a thought experiment here. So let's say we have this this large graph. We have our 20 billion vertices. We'll remove all the edges from this graph. Maybe we'll just keep the degrees at some constant value, and we'll start just like dropping edges in at random. So we'll convert this to a GNP random graph that has the right number of vertices and has the right edge probability to give us the right average degree. Okay, so now we'll ask, as n grows in that thought experiment, how many of these structures do I expect to see?
How many K2-3s or how many bipartite graphs?
How many K2-3s, let's say.
As n grows with p equals.
As n grows with p equal to 10 over n.
I'm sorry, what's
it? Sorry?
That graph.
Yeah. Oh, K2-3 is two vertices, each linking to each of three other vertices set. So it's five node subgraph with that edge set. And we're kind of glossing, I mean, what we're really talking about is a five-node subgraph that's isomorphic to this. So the expectation of the number of K2-3s as n grows large goes to zero. Okay, so in that, I know.
As a fraction.
As a what?
As a fraction.
No, in absolute. The actual number of K2-3s in that graph.
I'm sorry, are you saying that the number of sets of five vertices such that the induced subgraph is a K2-3 goes to zero? Okay,
oh.
Induced is the key point, right?
That's you
want to say that there's no other links except for
these
five.
Vertex-induced subgraph contains a subset of the edges that are isomorphic to a K2-3.
Good.
Right, so...
Thank you. Okay, now I believe it goes to zero.
Okay, great. Right, so you can have any other edges in there, there still won't be any of those. Right, that... There's no way the number of times, the number of ways that you can pick five vertices such that there exist six edges that go from the left two to the right three, that goes to zero.
Yeah, he's not saying what you want him to say.
Yeah.
No, it's not. No, it's sorry, not. No, I'm confused.
So now you're unhappy, right? You're
right.
Happy just for an instant.
You should be slightly unhappy.
Right. Yeah. You should be unhappy, so he's happy that you're unhappy.
Yeah, you're gonna
okay. You're surprised. Okay.
I'll say
surprise,
that.
It's surprising that you say that the number of induced K2-3 subgraphs goes to zero, because there's another scenario which is intuitively quite similar, where in fact the number of induced subgraphs gets very large, and that's what the issue is. I mean, imagine that the green graphs are people and the red graphs are hotels, and you want to detect terrorists by finding all groups of three people, such that those three people have stayed at the same hotel, have stayed at the same hotel for two different hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And with queries like that, if you have a database of 100 million people and 100,000 hotels, you will find so many groups of people that just randomly meet this criterion that the method turns out to be useless for detecting terrorists.
Right.
Well, his point is that the way people actually stay at hotels or the way people actually link, you do get a lot more of these bipartite graphs than you expect, but under a particular random graph bubble, you're not expecting any.
Exactly, yeah. And so even in this model, in which it's planted to be bipartite, as n grows, if there's truly no conditioning and everything's really independent, you still have this expectation.
How is n growing as you take n to infinity?
So we're saying that the average degree remains the same.
Okay,
here's the proof.
I think that solves the mystery.
The proof is trivial. I don't know. I have these five vertices. So I have like n choose five of them, and then I need these six edges to be present. And the proof follows from the observation that six is greater than five.
Right.
So that's my expectation. So okay. So I don't know.
And at this point, disagreeing with you would be a mistake. So,
six greater than five. I'll agree.
And then, if you're tempted to disagree, remember when the show comes.
Yeah, we do that. Maybe what I'll do, based on the observation about the imminent shuttle arrival, is I'll sort of observe that these things can be sort of mined from the graph, and they give you these sort of like tiny little communities, which tend to be very focused in nature. So somehow, like the fact that if people were just linking completely independently, you wouldn't see this, means that when you see it, probably it's because there's some kind of there's something non-random going on, which is of course that people tend to actually have interests in common. And I go and make my my web page, and I really like pictures of fish in stained glass windows, and I link to that one over there and that one over there. Somebody else has the same interest, and as soon as we both link to three things, there's a community of us that we don't know exists, but maybe it can be mined, and maybe we can then be connected together in some scary Big Brother stained glass window world. So finding these things is, it turns out these incredibly bizarre, narrowly focused communities. Like, it turns out there's a big community of people who like to put on inflatable sumo costumes and go into the mountains. So it's called fun sumo. You put on an inflatable sumo costume and you go into the mountains and you fight. And,
yeah, you have something wrong with that, then?
Absolutely not. I didn't mean to play. It's certainly okay. So you can find fun sumo with such a technique. And then you can also kind of
put your own hands on it.
So you can grow these five vertices out to the whole community. And there are some new techniques that are based on local random walks that are very nice, that are doing a much better job of that than what we've had in the past, which is nice to see, because it's always been very ad hoc up until now. Okay, so I will kind of skip a bit and talk about one particular online graph processing problem, and we'll see how we do. Okay, so we're given this large graph, and we're given two vertices S and T, and what we're supposed to do is convey to the user the relationship between S and T. Okay, so maybe let's say it's like a social network, maybe this large graph, as an example, and we're supposed to show the relationship between two people, Nicole Kidman and Cameron Diaz. So what we'd like to do is we can maybe just like use the standard approach out of the literature, which all the intelligence community is very excited about, which says that, well, if there's an edge between these two people, then that's great, and we'll show it. And if there isn't, then that's a little worrisome, but maybe we can find a path, and so we'll show the path. And so what we'd like to do is instead suggest that we want to show a little more. So this is maybe a potential more. So here there's actually a path between the two. There's also a length two path here, and then there's a couple of other paths and a couple of other edges that have been put in. So the abstract formulation of the problem is the following. Given a budget, which tells you how much a person can absorb on the screen at once, produce the graph subject to the budget, which best captures the connection between S and T. Okay, so that's the sort of abstract problem formulation. And so now I'll just tell you one random kind of concrete version of it. I don't think it's really been fully explored. Okay, so here's S and T in some graph. And so you can kind of imagine, okay, you're given a three-node budget. And so maybe this is the particular solution that you return. If you're given five nodes, maybe you throw in a couple of extras. But then if you're given six nodes, you might actually choose to do something different entirely and throw some of the other ones away. Okay, so here's a larger example showing David Filo, one of the Yahoo founders, to the guy who used to be my boss at IBM, Byron Dom. And so you kind of see random, like this is the guy who was CTO of Excite, and this is Sergey Brin and Larry Page. This is Bruce Max, who's faculty at CMU, and Prabhakar is the head of Yahoo Research now, and Byron reported to him. And so it kind of, this is all automatically generated, both the edges, which are mined out of web pages, and also the graph itself, which is built.
So that means they occurred in the same web page?
Yeah, right. So the edges, they occurred some number of times on web pages together. So in this case, this is definitely the wrong notion of connection, because it's just coherence. It's very weak. But it gives you some
effort. Something.
Yeah, right, something. Okay, so here's the proposed method for building the graph. So there's kind of three parts to it. Part one is you want to measure the quality of a path, and we're going to propose an approach based on kind of turning the graph into an electrical network and introducing some voltage to cause current to flow, and then we'll measure the quality of a path or of a subgraph based on the amount of current that's delivered. Then number two, once you're given that flow over the whole graph, how do you then pick a particular subgraph? And so here, we'll introduce a notion of delivered current through a subgraph, and then there's a dynamic programming algorithm that approximates it. It's hard to approximate as well as hard to solve exactly, but so it's a heuristic algorithm. And then part three, what you'd like to do is be able to run this on a large graph, like one of these 200 billion edge graphs, in real time based on a user query. So then you have to do some hacks to make it scale. So I'll see how I do. Maybe I'll just do like a few more minutes on this and then close questions.
Don't worry about it. It's interesting. It's for 10-minute block, so don't worry about it.
It's a healthy walk.
Okay, maybe we can have an optional whatever concluding. So maybe like how good is just one path? That is one question. So these are two paths. They have the same length, but somehow this is George Bush. This is like the person who has lots of connections to all sorts of people, and so this is probably not as good a path because it's a lot less surprising that this path exists because this is a high degree person. So shortest path alone, just intuitively, it doesn't seem like the right thing really. So what about network flow? So maybe if we're trying to push flow through this graph, then we're again a little worried because now this is a longer path that we're going to be able to push the same amount of flow through. So somehow we need to be doing some equivalent of siphoning off flow or something at each step in order to get something that really matches intuition a little better. Okay, so now let's imagine that we take our graph and we turn it into an electrical network. So in this case, we're going to lose. This is an undirected graph. So if it's co-occurrence on web pages, then it's sort of naturally undirected. Other things might be directed, and there isn't really a good analog of this. But you have to like introduce diodes or something. It doesn't really need to work. So we place a resistor on this wire, and the resistance depends on the weight of the connection. If they're very strongly connected, the resistance is very low. And then we place 1 volt here, and we ground the destination, and we just watch how current flows through. So this alone doesn't quite work because we have the same problem that we're going to have the same voltage here. But if we tweak it a little bit by kind of adding another grounded vertex here, and this is an asymmetric formulation where this has the same, it's grounded the same as the destination. But you can also look at other variants as well. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. The algorithm for doing this is exactly what you'd think. Adding this extra node doesn't make it any more complicated. So now, if we have this notion of what makes a good path, we want to talk about subgraphs. And so let's say that this is a flow, and you can imagine these are sort of like the flows are directed in the way you'd expect. And I want to consider giving this path. So it's natural to think, well, one unit of current is being delivered, but we want to think of it as half a unit. So the picture sort of looks like one unit is flowing here, one unit is flowing here, two units are entering here, and then one's leaving here, and one's leaving this way. And at this point, they all mix together. And so then they split evenly according to whatever the outputs are. So this is sort of the notion of if I only had this path and everything else was just dropping electrons on the floor, how many electrons would arrive? So that's the notion of the delivered current of a path, or more generally, subgraph. And so based on that, there's a dynamic programming algorithm which greedily adds paths based on the graph that I've found so far, augmenting it in the way that produces the best additional delivered current per units of budget that I had to employ in the new path. So if I add two nodes to create an extra path that may actually add many paths to the graph, that's fine. And then that allows me to deliver an additional 3 amps, then I give myself credit for 3 halves and I see if there's anything better. So that's the heuristic. It doesn't in theory work well. I don't remember the hardness of approximation, but it's really hard. It's like something to do with the size of the graph. Like I don't think there's any constant approximation. I don't think there's any like log approximation. Okay, and then scalability. So the idea, it's just sort of exactly what you expect, that you do sort of like double-ended Dijkstra, where you start at both sides and then start expanding out. So you have to expand from both sides, because if the graph looks like an expander, you only see the square root of the number of vertices, right, compared to just going one way. So you just sort of build out, and then you throw a bunch of heuristics in to decide which node should be expanded next, and you hope that you can find a way to bias yourself to pick one that that will find you a connection, then you can start to build up on the connection. So there's a bunch of work that offers natural data structures for finding these paths. You could imagine, for example, starting with a minimum spanning tree on the graph and using that to find your initial connection and see if you can build it out from there, or maybe a family of MSTs. That doesn't give you any provable properties, but all of this recent work on epsilon nets gives you a much more natural way to do this. Or maybe the tree embeddings work as well, hierarchically, well-separated trees. And so there's a family of things that could just be like, they're very natural things to look at, and we haven't looked at them. So that's that for this stuff. I'll show you just maybe one other picture. So we did some experiments connecting computer scientists to one another, and then connecting actors and actresses to one another, and then connecting computer scientists to actors and actresses, and which has never been done before, surprisingly. So this is the delivered current of the subgraph that was found by the algorithm using this many nodes worth of budget in the final output as a fraction of the total delivered current in the entire network. So you can kind of see, this is the worst case. But even here, once we get up to something reasonable that you can kind of fit on a screen and look at, you're getting 90% of the delivered current. So if you believe the metric, then it's doing a reasonable job. I don't think there's any reason to believe the metric. With that,